So thank you, everyone, for coming today. It's great to see such a great turnout. We also have the webinar going, so we also have some people online, hopefully, emailing in their questions when we get to that point in this session. My name's Charanjit Padam. I'm the chair of the, or the convener of the Climate Change Working Group of the Actuaries Institute. We're very pleased to be holding this event. Some of you may know that last year, at the end of the year, Mark Carney, the governor of the Bank of England, stood up in Lloyd's in front of the Lutine Bell and talked to the industry about the risks of climate change. Mark gave a very, I think, helpful grouping of the risks on climate change between physical risks, which are the risks generated by natural catastrophes and other weather-related events driven by climate change. Transition risks, which are the risks to as we transition in the economy to a low carbon economy as a result of policy changes and other technological changes from climate change. Things like stranded assets would be put in there. And thirdly, liability risks, which are the risks that we might face from shareholder action and other legal-type risks arising from climate change. So we've very much formatted today's session around that. We have Tim Andrews talking about physical risks or aspects of physical risks, including storms in Australia. We've got Emma Hurd talking about transition risks and giving us an investor's point of view about climate change. And lastly, we've got Sarah Barker, who will be talking about the legal aspects of climate change. So just to give you a brief introduction, we'll ask that the speakers go through their sessions. Each of them will speak for about 20 to 25 minutes, and then we'll have a Q&A session where you can put your questions to the whole panel at once. So Tim Andrews is an actuary and a director at Finity Consulting. He's been working insurance for more than 30 years. And he's currently the appointed actuary for four insurers. Tim leads Finity's natural perils practice area and has developed a number of products about rating, natural peril pricing, climate change, impacts of El Nino, and insurance claims costs. So very pleased to have Tim here with us. We'll then have Emma, as I said, talking about investors' point of view. Emma is the CEO of the Investors Group on Climate Change. It's a group representing members, superannuation funds and other investors of funds under management of at least $1 trillion. Prior to IGCC, Emma spent 15 years at Westpac Banking Corporation, where she did a number of roles, including carbon emissions trading and carbon finance and also climate change. She has participated in a number of key public forums, government and industry bodies relating to climate change and the environment. She's a non-executive director of the Carbon Market Institute and a member of the Cornerstone Capital Global Advisory Council. Lastly, we will have Sarah Barker talking. Sarah is a special counsel at Minter Ellison. She's a director at ESS Super and also the Responsible Investment Association of Australasia. She specializes in corporate governance and disclosure. Her work on directors' duties and climate change has been internationally recognized by institutions from the Bank of England to the United Nations PRI. She sits as a non-exec director on the boards of ESS Super, NRCL Limited, and the Responsible Investment Association of Australasia. She's also on the technical working group of the London-based Climate Disclosure Standards Board and is an academic advisor at the Smith School of Enterprise and Environment at the University of Oxford and a convening member of the Commonwealth Climate and Law Initiative. So I'd like you to welcome Tim Andrews to start speaking. Thank you.
Thanks, Charanjit. I was going to start today by talking about Forbes, or at least mentioning Forbes as an example where they almost had their highest ever flood. And it's kind of been trumped by Adelaide, of course, where we had the event yesterday, the Bureau calling it potentially a 1-in-50-year event impacting Adelaide and potentially something similar coming through again today. It feels like there's been lots of remarkable events in recent times. I mean, if I think about New South Wales, this year we had Stormageddon, and that's the event with the the properties disappearing into the sea up at Collaroy. Just at the end of last year, we had that. Remember that the tornado we had down at Kurnell? I should say, by the way, with Stormageddon, in many parts of New South Wales, that event produced the highest ever daily rainfall. So another kind of record in many parts of the country. With the tornado that occurred down in Kurnell, they were the highest winds that New South Wales had ever experienced at any time. So it kind of feels like there's lots of weather happening. And that kind of naturally leads to the question, well, is this climate change in action? Is climate change driving a more variable and higher cost environment? So that's really the theme that I'm going to spend time talking about today. And specifically, I'm going to start with and comment on what you'd hear if you asked a scientist that question. Because often you'll see they'll say something like, well, they'll probably firstly tell you it's pretty hard to work out what's happening to storms, so it's pretty uncertain. But then they'll say something like, we're expecting them to be more intense, so more intense events, and I'll describe what that means. But they're also saying that there might be fewer of them. So I'm going to have a bit of a chat to you about why the scientists are telling us there's more intense events, but potentially fewer of them. What's the science behind that? And then I'm going to kind of have a look at some of the data that exists so far to see if we can see anything in the data that might confirm that either of those two things are happening. So this is a layperson's take on the science as I go through this. Look, I'm not a scientist. I am an actuary. I have, in my work in doing natural peril pricing, I often get asked, how are the trends now compared to, or the costs now compared to the past? And in the course of doing that, and it's also something really that has really interested me, I spend a lot of time trying to understand how the costs are changing. So this is a layperson's take on the science. I know there's a couple of client scientists in the room, or at least, so I hope those guys go easy on me. One thing I would say is, I'm going to simplify a few things because I don't have a lot of time to talk to anyway, and it's pretty complicated. So I'm going to simplify it a bit, and I hope I don't lose too much in doing that. And the other thing on this particular topic, I'd say that the science is, it's relatively uncertain still. So if we can think about climate change and we can be, we can be comfortable with the science in terms of warming. So we've got high levels of confidence about the relationship between carbon and the warming of the Earth. So if we've got high confidence in that, the scientists have got less confidence about how that's going to manifest in terms of the storms panning out. And a lot of the work, by the way, is done. They have these general circulation models. So these are models where they've effectively put the world into cubes that are maybe 250 or 300 kilometres wide and high. And they then model the movement of the atmosphere and the oceans within these cubes via mathematical models. And those GCMs is a lot of what has been used to then provide this view I'm going to give you of the scientists' view about how climate change might impact. So they use these GCMs to look at what the world could look like in future, what's going to be the environment in terms of humidity, etc., and then to use that to assess how that's going to then pan out in terms of costs. So there's clearly high levels of uncertainty in using them at that quite granular level, and that's where the challenge comes from. In talking about storms, because that's what I'm focusing on, it's hard to do because there's so many different types. I've kind of grouped them into three types to simplify that. Thunderstorms, here I'm thinking, these are quite localised. Think about an event whereby the air heats up over the land during the day and rises. It's moist air, maybe we're near the coast. So moist air rising hits the cold air, we get a thunderstorm. So they're quite localised. The winds are typically not as strong as we get in some of the other events, although, supercells associated with these thunderstorms like we saw yesterday. Yesterday wasn't, by the way, it wasn't just a thunderstorm, it was a synoptic with associated thunderstorms. But these supercells can generate very strong winds over short, over quite localised areas. They're basically about moist air and warm air and that warm air rising. So I'll be talking a bit more about that later. They do like one thing in terms of making them larger, and that's something that the scientists call wind shear. So wind shear, and specifically vertical wind shear. So this is the winds moving at different speeds and directions at different elevations. And I say that because it's important to some of the comments I'm going to come to later. So besides thunderstorms, if they're quite localised, the synoptics, here we're talking about events impacting over a much bigger area. So that it can be states or multiple states, like we're seeing with this event in southern Australia at the moment. And essentially here we're talking about areas of cold air hitting areas of warm air and significant pieces of air. They don't happen everywhere. So I'm going to spend a bit of time in a second telling you about where they happen and where they happen is potentially changing. The other storm that people refer to, we've got cyclones here. So here we're talking about, these would have the strongest winds of these three types, of course. They need very warm water. So we're talking about water that's above 26.5 degrees. And they also need very warm very warm air and moist air to occur. So they're the three types I'm going to talk about. It's interesting for me that for each of those three, the scientists tell us more intense, less frequent for each of them. So let me tell you about why. The easy part is the more intense. So here we're talking about we're going to get more rain and we're going to get stronger winds. And the reasons for that are relatively simple for us to understand. The more rain, essentially, with the heating, we've got more evaporation occurring and we've therefore got more moisture in the air. And so when a storm does occur, we get more rain falling. For every 1 degree of warming, there's something like 7% extra moisture in the air. So that one's relatively straightforward. The more winds comes from the release of energy in these storms. So the energy gets released as the moist air rises and becomes rain, is converted into water droplets. That releases heat, releases energy. It's actually an important part of the cooling of the earth, the releasing of that heat into and so that energy being released, well, there's more energy being released because there's more warm water and there's more heat. So that drives stronger winds, so actually more vibrant events occurring. And similarly with the cyclones, closely related to that, you can imagine with more seas, I talked about they need very warm water. So, you know, there's going to be more often water above 26.5 and indeed a greater level of water above 26.5 degrees, and that's going to then drive that extra energy in those events. So that's where the intensity comes from. And when you look at those, you'd kind of think, well, isn't that mean we're going to get more of them? Because we've got, you know, they kind of need this moisture. And isn't that moisture and warmth going to lead to a lot more events occurring? So why are the scientists telling us that there may not be more? So here there's a couple of things I wanted to tell you about. The first is the way the world is warming. And it's not warming the same everywhere. So this is very important. This particular charts, they come from the IPCC's 2014 report. These are just two different warming scenarios. So if you focus on the right one, that's the stronger warming scenario, just because it's easier to see the differences. What you'll see here is that we've got, at both the poles, we've got a lot more warming than we've got in other parts of the country, and especially and including around the equator. So the poles are going to warm by more than the other parts of the globe. Why is that? I talked about how thunderstorms release heat. You can imagine around the equator we've got the thunderstorms releasing heat into the atmosphere. That's part of it. So the heat's getting released there, and it's getting released less often down here. The other piece is at the poles we've got a lot of the ice, and at the moment that deflects the heat back. And as the ice reduces in size, and this is especially the case up at the North Pole, and that's why we've got a lot more heating up there, then less ice, less deflection, more heating there relative to what we've got in the rest of the world. So what that does is it means we've got less variation in temperature between the coldest parts and the warmest parts. And, of course, that means then we have less. So if we move from the equator down to the pole, there's less variation in temperature here. So all else being equal, that means less times we're going to get cold air hitting warm air, and therefore less events. So that's one of the drivers for them saying potentially we're going to get fewer events going forward because we've got a lesser temperature gradient at play. The other piece that I find quite interesting is the way the lows and highs are going to kind of shift a bit. So the world isn't just a place where there's random low pressure systems and high pressure systems. So there's actually a lot of shape to that. Across the equator here, it's actually dominated by, it's essentially low pressure that sits across the equator. And if anyone's interested, I could talk to you afterwards about why this is. And then when we get to below the tropics, we get this area here that most of us live in, and it's kind of up to Queensland. This is what they call the mid-latitudes. And this is actually an area that's dominated, these reds, it's dominated by high pressure systems essentially arising through these mid-latitudes that we live in. And then we get, these are the polar lows down here. So they sit down here and they kind of creep up and down between summer and winter, which is what's happening on this chart. But we've got these domination of lows that come through here. And actually at the poles, we have high pressure systems again. So you'll see every now and then this high that's coming in down in the pole. So there's actually quite a bit of shape to that. So one thing that has been happening and we're told is we can expect to happen further is that these polar lows are shifting southwards. So compared to where they are now, they have been and they're expected to shift a bit further south. And in fact, the area of the tropics is expanding. So this shifting we're seeing in a number of areas across the globe in terms of where the patterns are. I find it hard to understand exactly these relationships, but linked to both this change in the temperature gradient and the shifting of the poles, that wind shear aspect I talked to you about is also changing. And the key things here is in the tropics, they're actually projecting increased wind shear. So we're going to have more wind shear up in the tropics. And in these mid-latitude areas, where they're projecting there'll be less wind shear occurring, which seems to fit with me. Wind shear is effectively instability in the air, and with that lessening of the temperature differences and the lows being further down south, that would seem to link to the reasons we'll be getting less of that wind shear occurring. So if I then look at each event and try to understand then why the scientists are saying what they're saying, and I forgot to tell you a very important piece of information about cyclones. They don't like wind shear. Basically, wind shear breaks up that instability in the air, breaks up the formation of a cyclone. So they don't like wind shear. So I just told you that in the tropics, we're going to get increased levels of wind shear. And that's the driving force for the scientists telling us that we're going to get fewer cyclones. So in effect, whilst with the warmer waters, etc., we'd be expecting more of them, the change in wind shear there is where the scientists think that may overwhelm it and we'll finish up getting fewer of them. But when they happen, they'll be more severe. If I compare that with the synoptic lows, what we've got here are two key things that are impacting. The first is that poleward shift, and I'm going to show you in the data soon whether we can see any of it yet. So we've got the lows dropping further south. So those mid-latitudes where these events occur, because we're not talking about events here that occur across the whole country, they're essentially in those mid-latitudes. They're shifting south and therefore there's fewer of them. And there's also less wind shear, and they like wind shear in terms of the generation of storms. So that leads to less storminess as well. So that's the reasons that they're telling us the synoptics may lead to less cost. Sorry, I shouldn't say cost, less of these events occurring. And thunderstorms, it's kind of up and down, because if you could think about, in North Australia, I remember thunderstorms like wind shear, so we're going to get more wind shear. So up there, we've got more moisture in the air, more wind shear. In Northern Australia, we're expecting to get more thunderstorms and more events occurring over time. Whereas for the rest of the country, this would suggest, that there's less wind shear, and therefore we're going to get less of those thunderstorms occurring elsewhere, despite that increased humidity. And the scientists kind of talk about that those things are working against each other, and that's where it's quite unclear which one's really going to finish up winning. But there's those two forces that are going in different directions at the current time. Okay, so I've done pretty well in my timing to get, that's the science, and as I said, I've done it pretty quick because there's a lot of stuff that sits behind all that. So what I'm going to do now is have a look and see if we can see what's happening in the data that might support these things. I'll say a few things about that before I start. Firstly, look, we're looking at pretty short time periods at the current time relative to what we're trying to see here, so it's really hard to see it. I'd also say that what we've seen so far is perhaps nothing like what we're going to see going forward, so we're trying to measure something quite early on. So there are a couple of caveats. And the last one, I've talked a lot about intensity and frequency. I'd like to be able to measure both those things. In practice, it gets quite hard. They kind of get mixed in together, and it's hard to unravel the two of them. But I'll have a go at doing my best to help you understand where things are at. I could show you intensity of rainfall in a lot of ways. This is just one of the slides you can pick up from the Bureau. It's just, I've picked this particular one up because it's the number of heavy rain days. So how often are there heavy rain days? And this is the change in those heavy rain days since the 50s when we've had the warming coming through. So you can see here we've got across a lot of the southern Australia and even up the coast a bit, we've got, it would appear, less days of heavy rain, except in the tropics where we've actually had these increases coming through. So that would seem to suggest that some of what I've been telling you about, the fewer storms in from the synoptics and the thunderstorms further south, might be panning out in terms of those particular heavy rain days. So that seems to support the science. Well, these blobs, you can see it's the number of days per 100 days. So these shifts are relatively small at this stage. They're not big shifts in the experience, but you can see they do look consistent. So whole areas seem to have a similar shape. This is a really good study, I reckon, as a way of assessing the intensity. This was a study done last year by some Australian scientists. They looked at data from weather stations, and they looked at 40,000 storms across 30 years. And they were scattered across 79 locations, so that's a lot of storms. It's about 17 per location. It's actually about, this study was really all of those events that were heavy rain under the Bureau's definition. They kind of matched that. So the key thing they did was they broke each of those storms into 6-minute intervals, and they had a look at the worst 6 minutes, and they looked at how much rain fell in that 6 minutes. And what they wanted to try and assess is whether that intensity, that amount of rainfall falling in that worst 6 minutes, was changing. And they found out that it was changing, that in that across that 30-year period, there'd been an increase in that worst 6 minute of rainfall intensity. But it was relatively modest so far. It was a couple of percent for the 1 degree of warming we've had so far. And they then had a go at estimating what future changes might be, kind of bringing that relationship into play. So yes, there is evidence there of that increased intensity, but through that study, relatively modest compared, again, to what we might get going forward. We do at Affinity, I do a fair bit of stuff with this weather station data, and I just wanted to briefly run you through that. And to give you an idea of it, this is Cairns. Each of these dots, this is since 2004. Every little arrow on that thing is a specific day and the level of the wind on that day and the direction it came from. And in Cairns, the things that kind of stand out for me are, look, it hardly ever gets above 60. So they have, you know, these daily thunderstorms, they're getting relatively low winds are coming from those. Not very often gets above 60. And then now and then they get a cyclone and the wind spikes up on those particular days. If I can compare that with Melbourne, which is quite interesting, Melbourne looks like this, same scale. You'll see, by the way, with Cairns, there's some seasonality, so you can see it changes from kind of the greens to the oranges, etc. in there. And in Melbourne, we can see the same kind of seasonality we've got. But in this case, we get the winter storms coming through. They're those big blue arrows with the storm, the wind coming down from the north. And now we're looking at lots of days where the wind's, well, some getting above 100 and plenty where it's getting above 80. These are the synoptics at play. So we're not now talking thunderstorms. We're talking about the synoptic lows that are producing these very strong winds coming through. It's interesting because a lot of people would think as North Queensland have been more risky than Melbourne, but in terms of the wind strength, well, perhaps it's the other way around, except for cyclones. Okay, so at Finity, what we do is we take those daily storm scores, sorry, those daily weather observations, and we've converted them to a assessment of, on that day, would it have produced a claims cost? And in effect, what we did is we had lots of days of high wind and high rain, and we matched those days to insurance claims cost, and we understood that relationship, and we then use it to look at long time periods to understand how claims are coming through over time. So that's what this particular study looks at. And what I've put on the left-hand side here are, these are the cities that are kind of towards the south of Australia and how they've been trending, and you'll see there's time series here back to the kind of 50s. And on the right-hand side, I've put the cities that are up the in northern Australia or up the east coast. So look at these guys, and we can see some reductions coming through. So this is suggesting over time, and by the way, I'd call this an index of storm cost, the storm insurance cost. And it would suggest that over time that that's actually been reducing in these southern states, southern cities, and there's less evidence of downward trends in elsewhere. And again, that, to me, seems to be matching what the scientists are telling us about the link between the synoptics and the southern areas. And one way I can also show you that is, this is just looking at Adelaide, funnily enough. These are 10-year averages, so it's not responding to the latest experience that they've had this year. And that's the same storm score over time, so this reduction over time. And then this particular line here, that's how many low-pressure systems have been going past Adelaide in that same period of time. So that's the density of lows that's been measured. And that's actually the mean sea level pressure that they've been getting over time. So with fewer lows, you get the mean sea level pressures higher. So that's actually been increasing. So we've got in South Australia, this we can see at play what the scientists are telling us. Fewer synoptic lows coming through there, less cost. So that kind of all matches for me. And I think we can see that again in some of the other southern states as well, and less evident if you look in the other area in other states. So I would say, by and large, what we're seeing in the experience is matching what the scientists tell us. It does make you wonder about what's going on in Adelaide now. One of my clients in Adelaide said to me earlier this year, "We've had a couple of storms. What's going on? Is there anything we need to worry about?" And I showed him this stuff. I said, "No, there's nothing to worry about in Adelaide." And since then, because that was a few months ago, they've had a couple of other big storm events already, and then followed by the events of their last couple of days, or today and yesterday. Now, it's quite important to understand that there's other things at play here. Now, this happens to be a very low pressure, big low pressure system that's coming through Adelaide at the moment. But the other reason they've been getting a lot of these storms is this thing called the Indian Ocean Dipole. That's essentially measuring where the warm water sits in the Indian Ocean. And the closer that warm water gets to Australia, the more storm and rain we get across Australia. And it kind of starts in the northwest and comes down towards Adelaide and New South Wales. So the Indian Ocean Dipole is at record levels at the moment, and that's been driving. Australia's had its, I think it's its second wettest winter ever. New South Wales has been the third wettest ever, and a lot of it's driven by this Indian Ocean Dipole. And that, again, is why Adelaide has had such a heavy storm period over the last... the Indian Ocean Dipole affects during winter and spring, and it's what we're certainly seeing come through at the moment. And then it just so happens at the same time we've had this very strong low-pressure system come through. So one thing that tells me is cycles are important. And if I also mention, in talking about cycles... And I know I'm running out of time. I've got about 1 minute left. I've got one slide to go. All I want to tell you about this is insurance claims costs over time. A lot of people would have seen this chart before, where it's normalised for inflation, et cetera, et cetera. And the blue bars, I've just pulled out the costs in that insurance council CAT register that are storm costs. And it's floods, storms, hail, or they're all in together. So there's kind of a grouping over here, and there's a bit of a grouping here. There's kind of, some spikes. It's really hard to assess any trends over relatively short time frames, but we do have this kind of relatively high level of cost coming through in recent times. So there's another cycle at play here, and that's El Nino, the Southern Oscillation. That's ENSO. And we had 4 out of 5 of these years were La Nina, and La Nina are the wet ones. So with all of this, there's these cycles at play that kind of make assessment of the trends difficult, is what I wanted to draw out from that. So to summarise, is the frequency and severity of storms changing? I'd say the first thing is it's actually very hard to know. It's hard to measure from the data, and relying on these GCMs is the best the scientists have got, but there's uncertainties associated with that. So one, it's difficult to assess. Secondly, the impacts will vary by region, and we are going to expect to see more events and severity of events in North Queensland, especially in the tropics, and potentially we're going to be seeing fewer events but more severe events when we look down at the southern states. In all of this stuff, if we're trying to understand what's going on, these normal cycles, the normal variability is really important to understanding what's going on. Impacts to date, I'd say the impacts so far are relatively modest, and that's probably what we'd be expecting. We're not expecting to see a lot of change yet, and that's as evidenced by that. Remember that 40,000 storms and the kind of results from there. The impacts to date do seem to be relatively modest. But I think what we're seeing in the data is consistent with the scientists telling us. And the last thing I'd like to finish on, that whenever I'm talking about storm, I like to reflect on, this isn't at all dealing with the other aspect of the environment that the storms will be operating in, and that is one of higher sea levels. And even if it's the same level of storms occurring with seas that are a metre higher, we're going to get very different experiences emerging. And if there are more severe events occurring with those same levels, with the sea levels a metre higher, it's going to be more significant again. In my view, that's going to be the biggest, the most important contributor to the changing environment for us in future, that rather than the change perhaps in the rainfall or the frequency of these, is how that higher sea level is going to play out. So with that, I'll hand over. Strangely, I haven't done too badly on time. And, yeah, thank you.
Say how lucky we were to have this presentation today when everything was going on in South Australia. It's actually incredibly fascinating having this discussion, and particularly on the context of storms, in light of everything else that's going on at the same time. So I have to admit, I thoroughly enjoyed that. So plug for the previous speaker. A little concerned about how I'm going to segue into this, because I'm going to take quite a different tact as well. I think, as Sharanjit said, so my constituency is institutional investors, so super funds, fund managers, asset owners, asset managers, that part of the finance chain, looking specifically at the question of climate change, looking at it from two perspectives. One, how are the policy changes in the macro external environment factors going to influence investors? But also, secondly, what should investors be doing themselves to be appropriately responding to these issues? And I'm going to focus more on the transitional risk side of the framework that Sharanjit set up as well. I'm just going to talk a little bit about how investors are thinking about carbon risk, talk a little bit about how you take the science and flip it into a financial risk, give you a couple of examples of big major international initiatives that are underway, which are driving a lot of thinking and change, and then also just give you a quick recap of what investors are actually doing. And I'm going to do that in 20 minutes, leave time for questions. So it's all right, I talk very quickly, so we can get through it all, I promise. So I want to start by talking about the Paris Agreement that was agreed at the end of last year. And I don't want to go through the detail of the agreement. I want to make a couple of key points about why it is so influential. The first being that it's all about the market signal that the Paris Agreement delivers. And it does this in a couple of ways. It does this by moving from a fixed point in time, do or die international agreement that you have to sign up to achieve specific goals. And it flips it to creating an actual pathway and process for continuous response and change, which actually aligns more with how the investment community thinks about policy change. It also inserts some specific numbers that you can then use in terms of working out potential financial impacts. It has a universal agreement, 195 countries roughly, all the developed and developing nations, all of our trading partners, all of our key export markets, all in the same agreement, all saying we're going to limit warming to less than 2 degrees. We're going to aim for 1.5, but 2 is the sort of real benchmark. And we're going to do that by moving to a net zero emissions global economy by the second half of the century. So those two numbers become incredibly important, 2 degrees and net zero emissions. So when you think about the pathway, the process that Paris sets up, where countries submit their own national plans, it's much more practical from a real sort of politics perspective. But also there's that continuous obligation to continue to review and ratchet up. So the process again kicks in and becomes that driver for direction of travel in terms of what we're likely to see. So the numbers, the process and the coverage of the agreement are what makes it a significant market signal for investors. So it doesn't matter where you're investing, what industry sector, what jurisdiction or where you're from, you're going to face some sort of climate change related investment impact. I think, as was also mentioned, the other really big initiative that was announced in December in Paris is the Global Task Force on Climate-Related Financial Disclosure, or TCFD, for those of us who don't speak in lengthy names, set up under the G20 Financial Stability Board Committee, chaired by Michael Bloomberg, very strongly pushed by the Bank of England, and also China are big supporters of this as well. And interestingly, Mark Carney's, a lot of his recent comments have been quite influential in terms of framing how the thinking is coming out of in this particular agreement, this particular task force. One, because he's sort of really highlighted the two key issues that the task force is really aiming to address here. The first being the mismatch in timeframes between climate change and the average investor outlook. Not that I want to diminish my own industry, but it would be fair to say long-term investment is a boutique industry in the investment community. Luckily, my constituency are all in the business of long-term investment, as is the insurance sector. So in that sense, you've got what Carney referred to as the tragedy of the horizon, where the costs are worn today of transitioning, but the benefits are felt in the medium term and in the future. And how do you bridge those gaps and bring the future costs into current investment decision-making? He also talks about how transition risk, the heart of transition risk, is this notion that success is failure. If we move too fast, move too hard, decarbonize too quickly, we're at risk of creating instabilities in our global markets and in our global economies. And this is particularly relevant, again, in the context of the debate, the very live debate about Australia's energy mix. This is not a discussion which is unique to Australia. Australia's energy discussion is the global energy discussion in a microcosm. So the framing of climate change as a financial risk, you know, with implications for investment, with profound implications for timeframes and the way that you think about risk and investment is the other really major influential factor in terms of how investors are thinking about these issues. And I'll come back to Carney and Bloomberg in a little bit. This task force is chaired by Michael Bloomberg. Potentially, he sees an opportunity in standardising disclosure. You might have a bit of a business interest there in developing new products and services for his core operations around standardised emissions and climate change reporting. It's not for me to judge. So, carbon risk. How do investors actually think about carbon risk? I think it's already been quite clearly set out. Carbon risk is the shorthand term for a whole range of different facets of risk. Physical risk and physical impacts, I think we've heard about so far in a really fascinating microcosm of one of the physical risks that that has the potential to impact our industries. And if you think about it, we didn't get into the costs, but costs of storms, implications for investment in infrastructure and property is already a live issue. Who wears the costs? Who capitalises on the benefits? Is it a private sector investment ask for a public benefit? Again, that's also a bit of a standoff that we're also moving into now. The other part of it, transition risk, which I'm going to talk more about, includes the policy and the regulatory response, but it also includes significant market transformation that's underway, again, relevant for the energy sector, and technological disruption. The imperative to decarbonise is similar in effect and impact as the introduction or digitalisation as a mega theme. It's not that it's one new industry sector will emerge. It's actually a behavioural change and a practice and operational change that will influence every industry sector. So it's a ubiquitous influence in terms of thinking about it. All of that gets shorthanded for carbon risk. So if I use the term carbon risk, understand that there's a whole, that's just the tip of the iceberg, no pun intended, in terms of the different elements of that I'm referring to. So transition risk, this is a complicated slide. I don't intend to talk through it, don't worry. It's a little blurry. I've nicked it from a report that was interestingly enough done by the European Systemic Risk Board, I might add, in terms of looking at financial risk stability implications for the EU of climate change responses. It's just aiming to set out pathways for achieving the two degree goal, not even the 1.5 degree goal, the 2 degree goal, a 66% probability of achieving the 2 degree goal, I should say. The red line is past and projected emissions. All of the other lines are where we need to get to on a carbon budget basis to actually achieve the goal of a 66% probability of limiting warming to 2 degrees. The thing that I want to highlight here is that is a steep turn. No matter which trajectory you're on, no matter when you start, and we should have started 3 years ago, I might add, no matter when you start, it's a steep turn. So any kind of reasonable effort to achieve 2 degrees, which is what 195 nations, all of our trading partners, Australia has bipartisan political support, all of us have signed up for, that's the implication of it. So this is not going to be small tweaking at the edges. This is going to be profound structural transformation. Who benefits, who gets it right, over what time frame, how do you get your investments in and out in a way that actually, you know, ensures ongoing returns is the key question for investors in every industry sector. And this is without dealing with physical risk implications as well. This is just transition risk. So I think sometimes there's a bit of a disconnect in the conversation that we're having around climate change and understanding that transition risk is the steepness of the turn. So how does this become a systemic risk? Well, there's a couple. I'm going to work through this slide, starting with the bubbles on the energy side and moving across back across to the other side. If you're thinking about getting to a net zero emissions economy, there's a couple of stats that are worth remembering. One is that more than 80% of global emissions come from energy-related activities, and two, more than 85% of global energy-related activities are derived from fossil fuels. So clearly, any kind of decarbonisation imperative is going to hit the energy sector, generation sector, extraction sectors first. This has other implications in terms of transmission infrastructure, as we're seeing now in Australia, but everywhere. But it also has implications in terms of energy costs. So we are not going back to a world where there is cheap energy in the foreseeable future. And if it does become more affordable, it will be because of technological change, things such as the introduction of storage, profound changes in grid infrastructure. So these three moving parts are really key in understanding the some of the hyperbole in the energy debate. There is an intense debate going on for competitive positioning as we move into this new kind of energy landscape. And this is going to be happening for 10, 20, 30 years, but it's happening now and it started about 10 or 20 years ago. So we're not at the beginning of this journey. This is a process that's underway. It also has implications in terms of every other aspect of the economy. We're all energy users. Also, we're all households. We all have energy bills. This question of energy bills and household energy prices is also something that will continue to affect the returns and the cash flow implications for every other investment as well. The reevaluation question is, again, that steepness of the turn. What are the implications for people investing now in new coal mines, for example, that are going to be operating over a 30, 40, 50-year lifespan when you're moving into a world where there's decreasing demand for carbon-intensive energy sources? This is not going to happen instantly. We're not going to switch it off. But how do you ensure that you will get your returns over the period in which you're investing? How are you actually assessing and understanding the export markets into which those assets are intending to generate their sales when they've got their own decarbonisation goals as well? There's no black or white answer here. It's not no coal or all coal. It's actually going to be a sort of gradiated process of decarbonisation, and investors will be moving in and out of that landscape continuously. Of course, the other part of it is, if you're thinking about Australia's economy, is that the two largest industry sectors that all of us generate our super returns from, pretty much, unless you're in a deep green, totally divested ethical investment fund, all of us get our returns from the two largest industry sectors in the economy are the mining sector, mining and resources, and financial services, both of which are exposed to different aspects of carbon risk. So, I mean, banks are exposed to the entire economy. But also they have one of their single largest pools of assets are mortgage lending, which are very exposed to physical risk. And they're also big debt providers to generation facilities and the mining and resources sector, both of which are very exposed to transitional risk and market and technological change. So the two largest sections of the Australian economy are very carbon intensive and very exposed. How are we managing that from a system-wide perspective? And then, of course, more than 85% of us live on the coast, as is all of our infrastructure, pretty much. and all of that is exposed to the increasing severity of storm fronts, and that's leaving aside bushfires and water scarcity issues and coastal sea level rise and inundation. So I don't want to paint a particularly bleak picture here, although obviously I just did, but clearly no matter where you go, there are risks that need to be managed. And on the flip side of every risk is an investment opportunity in terms of a new service provider, a new technological change, a new form of investment structure which can be supported to actually deal with some of these risks. I want to quickly flip to looking at a couple of examples of things that are going on overseas, which are also influencing how investors are thinking about their response, and which also loops back to both how do you assess and accurately assess and price your risks, how do you look at this on a portfolio perspective, and how do we all ensure that we're looking at the right information and data sets. So in France, they have recently, or last year they introduced the French Energy Transition for Green Growth Law, which for short is called the Energy Transition Law. I mean, this basically is their equivalent of a renewable energy legislation, but there's one particular section of it that is especially relevant for our constituencies, and that's the provisions under Article 173, which requires very prescriptive disclosure around carbon risk. So it requires listed companies to disclose financial risks related to the effects of climate change, the measures that companies are adopting to reduce them, and the consequences on the company's activities and the use of goods and services it produces. So this is accentuating already mandatory environment, social and governance risk reporting requirements. It also asks banks and credit providers and institutional investors to disclose the risks of excessive leverage and the risks exposed by regular stress tests, and information on how their policies align with the National Strategy for Energy and Ecological Transition, aka the Paris Agreement. So institutional investors in particular don't really know how to do this yet. They've got until next year before they need to start reporting. And it's actually driving driving the growth in consulting agencies specialising in this area, but it's also driving global behavioural change around how investors are thinking about disclosure. And if you think back to the Mark Carney and the Bloomberg and the task force, that also looks at not just corporate disclosure but investor disclosure. So this is actually proving to be the sort of one of the real world examples that's driving the thinking and the voluntary initiative that all of us will end up adopting. So it's proving to be quite influential. And a number of my members, Australian institutional investors, have recently been schlepping over to Paris to find out what's going on, because they're pretty much thinking they'll be doing the same reporting in the next couple of years. The other part of it is China. I mean, interestingly enough, China is incredibly active in this space. So earlier this month, the Asia Investor Group on Climate Change released a report looking at the response of the finance sector across 12 markets, including Australia and 11 Asia-Pacific markets, on what the finance sector is doing in response to climate change. The two most active markets were Australia and China, and China left Australia for dead in terms of what the finance sector was doing. And a lot of this was driven by a lot of the green finance provisions that the Chinese government has introduced. And in particular, under G20, it was the first time that the G20 communique actually included explicit provisions around green credit finance provision and green lending guidelines as well, and an ongoing commitment to continue to look at green finance provision as a key area. This is all sort of presided over by a decision by the Central Leading Group for Comprehensively Deepening Reforms to transform China's financial system to facilitate green investment. And China doesn't really have guidelines per se. It tends to have mandatory regulatory required change, so we'll call the guidelines mandatory requirements, for establishing a green finance system, looking at green credit, green development funds, green bonds, green equity index products, green insurance and carbon finance, and also introducing a host of specific policies, regulations and incentives, including around the central bank's re-lending operations, interest subsidies and guarantees. It's also looking to establish a national green development fund, much like Australia's CEFC or the UK's Green Investment Bank. So when I was in Asia a couple of weeks ago, every single investor meeting I went to said that their three primary concerns at the moment were returns, green bonds, because China said that they have to do them, and renewable energy lending, because it was the big growth opportunity in a low-yield investment environment. So China's movement is moving investment outcomes across the entire Asia-Pacific region. And as we know, they're also quite keen on investing into other jurisdictions and markets as well. So if you put these together, the implications for Australian financial services are that strengthening corporate disclosure is going to happen. It will happen. I think the Global Task Force report comes out later this year, so it's good to be thinking about it now. And that the related exposure of financial companies need to be stress tested against transition scenarios, and that we need to be developing more tools and guidance frameworks to actually deal with some of these issues. So these are the specific objectives of the TCFD. And you'll see that it's really bucketed into two areas. One, practice, and two, the implications for financial regulators. Australia's financial regulators are on the G20 FSB committee and have been involved in some of the discussions around what the implications would be for Australia's broader financial system stability oversight. I'm sure Sarah's going to talk more about some of the specific legal requirements as well. It'd be fair to say they're keeping a low profile on this issue, but they are definitely active and aware of it. So it will be interesting to see what the reaction is of the Council of Financial Regulators post the release of the report when it's actually submitted to the G20 FSB committee in November, of course, which Australia is a member. What do investors want to see out of this process? And I just want to talk a little bit about the things that investors have been calling for in terms of enhanced disclosure from both corporates and from each other in terms of how to manage climate risk as a financial risk. And some of it's fairly straightforward, but I'll just go through it a little bit in terms of the climate angle on what we're talking about. So investors are really looking for evidence of capacity and capability at the board and executive level to appropriately understand and manage climate change risks. They're looking for completeness of reporting. So it's great if you've got one division which reports into European markets, which has fantastic disclosure, but if the bulk of your operations are in emerging or industrializing economies and they don't do any reporting, then this is clearly also an issue. It's also not just, if you think about Australia's emissions reporting requirements, where you're only required to report your operational emissions, that's great, but it doesn't include any of your equity exposures, which is actually the financial risk dimension of emissions reporting. So completeness is a factor there. Comparability, and a good example would be the four major banks in Australia who all do reporting on financed emissions, as it's called, or their exposure to lending into the energy sector, all use different reporting frameworks, all report different things, all report different products, all use the same language and the same tools and the same structure for reporting, and it's comparable to varying degrees. And I say this because I used to do the reporting for one of the banks, so I kind of know what I'm talking about there. Forward-looking. It's not enough to just be historical last 12 months material risks anymore, which is A, the cornerstone of traditional financial reporting, but also B, how most ESG mandatory reporting requirements set out the identification of material financial risks. You know, climate change is one of those factors that will never be a material financial risk in any one particular year until you're out of business. It actually requires a shift to forward-looking analysis and forward-looking reporting. And this is incredibly problematic for most companies for many reasons. But it also means that the task force can provide is standardisation around forecast scenarios against which you assess your performance. And I understand that there's something that they're actually looking at. And then you probably would again get industry convergence around what an appropriate methodology is for industry-specific forward-looking scenario analysis as well. I think that's where we're likely to see it going. And then how are you going to make money out of it? I mean, that's the main thing investors want to know. The commercial response. Where's your new, what's your R&D investment into new and emerging opportunities? How are you better positioned relative to your peers? How are you able to provide more competitive low-carbon options within your industry sector and to new and emerging client bases as well? You know, AGL is a good example of that. They make most of their money today out of their coal-fired generation assets. They're spending most of their R&D money in their new clean energy division. So it's interesting how some companies are dealing with these issues or spinning out particular assets into wholly separate companies altogether. And then finally, this question, what are the financial regulators doing and how they're thinking about it? I think there's increasing desire to get clarity around this particular question. And in Australia, I imagine that this will also be more of a live question. So what have I got, like 5 minutes? Am I out of time? 5 minutes. So I'm just going to flip through what investors are actually doing. Measuring, engaging, reallocating, and reinforcing. Okay, I'm done. No, so what they're actually doing is there's a whole bunch of industry collaboration around trying to understand what the role is of different investors against this landscape. So understanding what their own portfolio level exposures are and having some of our own industry standardized sort of approaches to understanding portfolio level emissions is a very big area of focus at the moment. Again, no one's that fond of footprinting, but everybody's doing it. Everybody's trying to find how you turn it into something useful. If you end up with a set of figures which tells you that your portfolio of assets is so many tons of greenhouse gas emissions per dollar invested, what does that mean? And how do you actually use that on an ongoing basis? So there's a lot of thinking around that. The Portfolio Decarbonisation Coalition is a coalition of investors who are voluntarily committing to set targets to reduce the carbon intensity of their portfolio. And again, there's different ways that they're doing it. And a recent example would be CalPERS, who reviewed their 10,000 equity investments, identified something like 180 companies that were responsible for about 75% of their total emissions, and they're just focusing their corporate engagement activities on them. So there's different ways that investors are being sort of smart around identifying and managing this risk. The Low Carbon Investment Registry is a sort of voluntary open source registry which has been set up to sort of show the different ways that investors are looking for opportunities and how they're structuring and developing investment products and tools to do it. So it sort of ranges everything from green bond mandate allocation to multi-fund developing economy structures to total portfolio decarbonisation commitments to strategic asset reallocation strategies. There's a number of different models on there that sort of shows different investors in different jurisdictions and how they're doing it. It's got about $50 billion of assets under management on there at the moment. And then lastly, there's a huge amount of collaboration. So the Global Investor Statement on Climate Change was published just immediately before Paris, which had around 420 global investors and around $24 trillion US of assets under management, all calling for a strong agreement in Paris. This sort of trend is continuing. So you're actually seeing in the lead up to G20, another coalition of investors called on the G20 to ratify Paris. This sort of level of investor collaboration is continuing. You're also beginning to see it increasingly in shareholder activism activities or corporate engagement collaboration is another big area where you're increasingly seeing investors agreeing to ask for the same things, and it's usually 2-degree stress testing or scenario analysis from corporates. Yeah, okay. Physical risk, just one quick plug. So adaptation is the other big area, which I haven't really talked about. It's a huge cost, significant opportunity, very undercooked, a lot more work to do. And I just point you towards the report that we did. And I'll stop there and leave it for the panel. I guess my final comments would be that this is an incredibly complex area. There's lots of moving parts. You have to think about it in the way that investors are increasingly thinking about it is an integrated approach to carbon risk, which is dealing simultaneously with the transitional and the physical risk implications, but also trying to work collaboratively with the rest of the investor community to compete on the commercial outcomes. So the facilitating the transition or managing the transitional risk is very much seen as a financial imperative. And my constituency is not just the deep green funds. It's actually the biggest, the most mainstream, the most exposed, invested across all aspects of the economy funds as well. So I'll stop there and leave it for the panel. Thank you. Feel free. I tend to get a bit. Now, it was press escape and hover. I'm good at other things. Huzzah. Rightio, I'm going to start with a confession, which is that I haven't calculated the slope of a regression line probably since about 1993. But we are not too dissimilar, you and I, because I'm a corporate lawyer in a defendant firm, and corporate lawyers in defendant firms care about risk and care about money. And that's all we care about. We don't care about the environment. We don't care about polar bears. We don't care about the community. We don't care about any of that. So as far as the issue of climate change goes, I'm looking at it through a corporate law, risk, liability, money-based lens. And the way I like to divide thinking around this issue up is very much the structure that Charanjit has set out for us today with the three speakers.
which is the way that the Bank of England structures its thinking around the financial aspects of risk associated with climate change. So you've got the physical impacts, which Tim's talked to us about. We've got the economic transition risks, which are the financial risks associated with the market's responses to those physical impacts, the regulatory responses, the technological responses, which Emma's talked about. And now I'm going to focus on that third area of financial impact, which is liability consequences. So what I'm going to talk to you about is not liability under environmental laws, if a carbon tax is reintroduced, anything like that. I'm looking at the corporate laws that we have now and considering how those bog standard corporate laws are applied or can be applied, are being applied internationally to corporate failures to manage the financial risks associated with climate change. So I'm going to look at corporate risk exposures, and I'll focus on negligence, the law of tort, and misleading or deceptive conduct, and also directors' liability exposures, personal liability exposures, because that has consequences in terms of driving behavioural change within organisations, but also for financial lines of insurance. And I know that many of you are involved in the insurance industry who are here today. So there we'll focus on fiduciary duty implications and also misleading or deceptive conduct. Now, as I'm going through, I would encourage you to think about, through your lens, what that means for your calculations and your methodologies, what it means for risk, what it means for valuation and ratings issues, feedback loops, how they might apply in terms of these threats of litigation being a driver of behavioural change, and also what it might mean for financial lines of insurance. So starting with the corporation, the company, what are the liability risks associated with climate change there? Now I'm going to start with negligence. What is negligence? Negligence is where we're talking about a company. A company has a duty of care to take reasonable precautions against reasonably foreseeable risks of injury. So you're acting negligently when there's a risk that you did know about or should have known about, and you had an obligation to minimise the impact of those risks as they might befall someone that you have a duty to. Now, so far when we've thought about climate change litigation, there have been no successful negligence cases. So there have been a few cases in America where, say, for example, groups of Eskimos have sued ExxonMobil and said, well, you were negligent, you breached your duty of care to us Eskimos, and we've suffered loss because you failed to take reasonable precautions against the impacts of your emissions causing climate change, which caused sea level rise, which then are eating into our territorial homelands. Now, that falls down because, on so many levels, but first of all, because it's difficult to argue that Exxon had a duty to take care for the interest of a particular group of Eskimos in Alaska, let alone all the other causation impacts around, you know, localised emissions and the temporal and spatial processes that everything has to go through between a refinery in Texas and the atmosphere a couple of decades later in Alaska. Anyway. But that's changing. The focus of the litigation is changing because the entities that are starting to say, hang on, you owe me a duty of care and I've suffered loss because of your failure to take reasonable precautions, are shareholders. And other entities that have a financial interest where it is a lot more easy to draw a line, a causal line and a duty of care line. The leading case there is one I love, Illinois Farmers Insurance in Chicago. And you might think, oh, yeah, Illinois Farmers Insurance, some pissy little two-bit, you know, farmers company in the Midwest. It's actually a subsidiary of Zurich, so it's, you know, relatively large. So this arose out of Hurricane Sandy. Now, Hurricane Sandy or Superstorm Sandy in the US in 2012, you might remember, caused a lot of damage. not the least because the level of the sea level around the coast in the US was 30 centimetres higher when that storm hit than it had been in 1950. So that links into what Tim was saying about the severity of storms being so much greater when you're starting from a much higher sea level base. And I think I'm digressing here, but they calculated that there was 11% more damage caused by that storm as a result of the sea level being 30 centimetres higher than what it was. I digress. So, Illinois farmers paid out a lot under its property insurance policies to both households and businesses after Hurricane Sandy. There was a lot of stormwater damage to houses in the Chicago area. The insurance company then turned around and sued the local governments in Chicago, 12 of the local governments, and said, okay, we've suffered loss as an insurance company because we've had to pay out under our policies. That is your fault. Because you knew that the projected levels of rainfall were a lot higher because of climate change. And you did not upgrade your stormwater and sewage infrastructure to be able to cope with those projections of severity. Now, that claim was withdrawn after 3 weeks. Two reasons. First of all, there's a tort immunity, sovereign immunity provision in Illinois, which means that you can't hold local governments liable for negligence anyway. And also, Zurich was underwriting was providing insurance to the local councils that were being sued. So it was suing itself. But that's where I think it's so significant, because it was a safe bet for them. And to me, it's strategic. They were drawing a line in the sand and saying, hey, infrastructure owners out there, don't think you can sit back and rely on the fact that there is insurance at play as a reason not to upgrade your infrastructure. Because we are going to chase our losses. We have shareholders that we have to report to answer to, and we're going to chase our losses. So I think that was a very, very significant case. So that's the first area that companies are going to have to watch out for, negligence claims. The second is misleading disclosure, as Emma alluded to. Now, there are lots of ways that a company can make misleading statements. I'm going to focus on annual reports and financial statements. So you can be misleading in your financial reports based on the valuation of your assets, say in a line item in your annual report. You can be misleading in terms of the assumptions and methodologies that you use in calculating particular disclosures. And you can be misleading in the context of the narrative disclosures that you make either around those assumptions and methodologies or in terms of what your forward-looking risk exposures are. Often they're contained in director's reports, in annual reports. And in each of those situations of misleading disclosure, we are starting to see cases where climate change is being applied as a driver of misstatement or as the cause of the misstatement in the annual reports. So starting with line items, and this is a big issue in Australia, asset valuation and revaluation and its methodology. ASIC last year issued a bulletin, I'll call it a bulletin, not sure what the technical phrase was, saying the focus of our regulatory reviews of annual reports this year is going to be asset revaluations in the mining sector. Not necessarily because of climate change, but because of the structural or the cyclical, however you want to have it, decline in the mining sector. Now, last week, the Securities and Exchange Commission in the US, who's the financial services regulator over there, announced it, well, it didn't announce because it's keeping very mum about it, but Exxon was forced to reveal that it is being investigated by the SEC due to its failure to restate its assets, which are predominantly contained in its oil reserves, its proven oil reserves, as the price of oil has fallen from over $100 a barrel to around $50 a barrel. And that is going to be potentially super significant. You can imagine for a company where 80% of the capitalized value is made up of the reserves it has on its books. So you can imagine then the plaintiff law firms who are rubbing their hands together with glee and saying, "Wacko, when this share price falls, we're going to have a huge big class of angry shareholders who are chasing their losses who want to sue Exxon to say, well, you misled us by saying that this was the value of your assets when it wasn't." And that's a bog standard stock dropped case. It's just the application of standard corporate law in a climate context. Happened to Shell 10 years ago where they were forced to reclassify 20% of their reserves, reclassify them from proven to probable. And their share price fell by 7.6% overnight. They were fined more than $300 million by regulators on both sides of the Atlantic and had two massive class action payouts as well. So it's, you know, it's big dollars here. And the lawyers win again. Assumptions and methodologies. Obviously very relevant to you as actuaries in terms of potential consequences of models failing to take relevant risks into account. And we saw this particularly in the GFC. So NAB, for example, had a shareholder class action brought against it in which it was forced to pay out $115 million, or settled for $115 million plus costs, in relation to its misleading disclosure of bad debt provisions or bad debt liabilities arising from the subprime crisis in the US. So in early 2008, NAB increased its bad debt provisions by about $180 million and came out and said to the market, "Oh yeah, this subprime thing in the US, we know it's a thing. So we're increasing our bad debt provisions by $180 million. We've done the sums, and that is, you know, more than enough that we're ever going to need as a buffer." 4 months later, it re-increased that provision by $1 billion. So the shareholders again, stock dropped by 14% overnight. Shareholders again sue the company and say, "We'll have that gap back, thanks. We'll have that loss back." So similarly, as actuaries, if you are failing to price these risks in when you are looking at valuation questions in particular or provisioning questions, that can have significant consequences from a liability perspective for the companies for whom you work, potentially also yourselves, but we'll get to that in a second. The last category of misleading disclosure is caveats. So when you are making projections about things and you are putting in caveats around uncertainty, forward-looking risk disclosures, all that kind of thing that no one has a crystal ball about to project with any certainty. Now, the theme that we have very, very clearly coming out of all the cases is that boilerplate language around risks and factors that may materially impact on the projections that you are making is no longer sufficient. It needs to be specific, the caveats that you are giving in relation to any potential projections that you're making. And there's this great quote in a US case that is not binding in Australia, but I just love this quote. "Person who warned his hiking companion to walk slowly because there might be a ditch ahead when he knows with near certainty that the Grand Canyon lies 1 foot away." And you can readily apply that principle in the context of climate change. Regulators overseas have started calling out fossil fuel companies in particular who are making these generalised bog standard disclaimers to their demand projections, saying, "Oh yeah, that might change because of climate change." It's not good enough. It's not good enough when this is basically something that is going to impact on their entire business model. So we saw that late last year where the New York Attorney General entered into an assurance of discontinuance, which is a fancy way that the Americans say settled with Peabody Coal, who was, before it went bankrupt, the largest listed coal company in the world, in relation to the way it was forecast or disclosing in its annual report the potential impacts of climate change on its business. So it was misleading. Their annual reports for 5 years were misleading in two respects. First of all, they made statements along the lines of, it's not reasonable for us to quantify the potential impact of climate change or regulatory responses to climate change on our business because it's also uncertain. When, in actual fact, they'd done a hell of a lot of internal modelling and stress tested and scenario planned, and their own internal models did demonstrate that there was a potential for a significant and very material impact on the value of their business from climate change. So that was just a standard lie, basically. Nothing magic about that. The second context was that Peabody had projections in its annual reports and in other disclosures around where it saw demand for coal going over the next number of decades. And it used information provided by the IEA, the International Energy Agency, which publishes projections every year of where it sees demand for various fossil fuels going over the next couple of decades, out to 2050. And so Peabody used the IEA projections that showed that the IEA saw coal demand rising by 40% through to 2050, which was literally true. But it was misleading because it also failed to disclose that the IEA also has a number of other demand scenarios that it publishes. And Peabody had only used the high carbon business as usual. This is what demand will look like if we are staying a high carbon economy scenario, without disclosing either the existence or the impact of the medium carbon scenario or the low carbon scenario, which now, particularly after Paris, the world has agreed to change to. And of course, demand for coal looks very, very different under those scenarios. So now you've got the regulators starting to come in and apply standard corporate laws in these contexts. It was also announced, in addition to that SEC investigation of ExxonMobil's asset valuations, attorneys general in 20 states in the US are now investigating ExxonMobil to ascertain whether or not they have engaged in misleading or deceptive conduct over the last 20, 30 years and misled the market by, on the one hand, internally recognising the science on climate change and internally going, wacko, less ice in the Arctic means more drilling for us, whilst publicly trying to foment uncertainty around climate change science and playing a blocking role in terms of regulation of carbon emissions, et cetera, et cetera. So trying to ascertain whether or not it's misled the market. Yep. I have six. Not only that, and I won't dwell on this because Emma's already touched on it, regulators around the world are now issuing specific guidance on what companies and investors need to disclose around the financial aspects of climate risk. Gold standard there, the Californian Insurance Commissioner, David Jones, which is only funny in Australia, has for the last number of years issued a six-page questionnaire every year to all insurers in his market, which is all the big insurers in his market, requiring them to disclose how they manage climate risks. And the questionnaire is very specific, and it asks questions not only around how they assess the physical impacts of climate change and the impact on their general property insurance side to their business, but also how they do it on the financial line side and what assumptions and methodologies they apply, etc., etc. The other gold standard is the French Energy Transition Law Article 173, which Emma mentioned, and also the forthcoming Bloomberg, the guidance coming out of Bloomberg. Also personal exposures for directors. Historically, climate change has been dismissed as an issue that directors and corporations need to think about on the basis that we have duties to act in the best interests of the company slash our shareholders, and those interests are financial. So if we do anything that benefits the environment, that has an inverse impact on our bottom line, therefore we're not acting in the interests of our shareholders, therefore we can't do it. But as the presentation so far today have shown, that no longer holds. Climate change is a significant financial risk. It is wholly and solely consistent with your obligations to act in the best interests of your shareholders financially to be managing this risk. And in fact, if you don't, then you're breaching your duties. So if you have an obligation to have regard to climate change because it's in the best interest of your stakeholders or your shareholders, I beg your pardon, what does that mean in practice? As a director, you have to exercise due care and diligence. It's not an excuse that you don't know anything about it. It's not an excuse, even if you are genuinely a climate skeptic, because if you had educated yourself about the issue sufficiently, you would also know that that view differs from 99% of the market stakeholders who are acting on the basis of their belief that it is a thing. And therefore, that exposes your company to financial risks. Similarly, with uncertainty paralysis, yeah, it's hard. Yeah, we don't know. But sitting on the fence is making a decision to continue with business as usual. Perfect is the enemy of good. You've got to do something about it. And similarly, if you're defaulting to, well, there's no carbon tax, we do whatever the law requires us to do, we're no worse than anyone else in our industry, that is not exercising due care and diligence to maximise the financial well-being of your company. You have to consider what is best for your company in the circumstances, and that can't be to do nothing. There have now been a couple of cases brought under those principles overseas in the US, and complaints referred to the Financial Reporting Commission in the UK, where allegations have been made against pension fund trustees and directors who have failed to strategise around climate risks, which have then led to had negative financial consequences for business. So I'll just leave you with my lawyer's list of things that I reckon you guys should be considering, although I would really appreciate your insights on all of this. You know, what does your due care and diligence look like? What are you doing to take these factors into account when you are asked to do company valuations or asset valuations or credit risk ratings or bad debt provisions? What adjustments do you need to make to your models, both on an individual company basis or on an entire sectoral basis? The way that, for example, we have with pharmaceutical companies. What does it mean for insurances on the financial line side? What does it mean for increased risks of claims under PI policies, under D&O policies? And what does it mean for your own insurances, your own PI insurances? So I will sit down, Sharanjit, before I start getting things thrown at me, and I look forward to the panel discussion.
We are unfortunately running well over time, so hopefully we get time for a couple of questions. Emma has to run at 2 o'clock, so if you see her heading out the door, she might come back. Hopefully we'll get a few questions before then. Look, I think we have been very privileged to have three of the leading experts in Australia on these particular topics and on climate risks. So please do take advantage of the opportunity here to ask a question. Please do raise your hand and let the microphone come to you before you start speaking. Go.
I wonder if it's the list of legal issues looming over everyone that's got them sitting there going.
Can we have a question here? Just a second.
Sorry. Just say my name.
Yes, please.
Daniel from Berkshire Hathaway. The instance of the Illinois, the Zurich Insurance Company against the state of Chicago, where does that, I mean, if that were to have proceeded and in any possible scenario where it could be successful, where does that end? So what about the shareholders of Zurich Insurance for the failure of their actuaries to correctly price for the increase in risk, and essentially, you know, kicking the can one further step down the road in terms of whose fault this all is.
I don't think the shareholders would sue the actuaries personally, but they might sue the board for their failure to strategically direct the business to be having regard to those issues.
Yeah, correct.
I don't think it'll go that far, but if you look at all the big litigations, even in Australia the last couple of years, you've got the bushfires litigation where the suing an infrastructure owner and the risk of bushfires is going to get higher. You've got the Wavenhoe Dam litigation happening up in Queensland at the moment where you've got more extreme rainfall due to happen. And the principle I like to apply, there is this great quote that said, even the most impassioned environmentalist has nothing on a homeowner facing negative equity. And it really just demonstrates that if someone has suffered a financial loss, they will look to blame someone and look to recover that loss. So there's going to be a lot more random litigation all over the place where people are trying to blame someone else and recover the loss from someone else.
And but so what's your view on the insurance company, you know, suing the infrastructure provider rather than listening to Mr. Andrews and increasing the prices, you know, for this sort of thing? Like,
well, that's the thing. Who's the insurance company could also say, you know what, we'd factored that risk in to our models, but that doesn't stop us from chasing our losses where someone else has been negligent and that has caused that loss to crystallise.
Sure. Thank you.
I mean, think of the Latrobe Valley gas situation in Victoria 20 years ago as well, similar kind of thing.
Time for one more question.
Hi. I guess I'm interested from the investment side. And I guess, what do you think in Australia the kind of conversations are happening between, say, the investors and the government and trying to get some of this innovation to start happening? And is there pressure coming from the investment side as well, do you think, towards government?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, well, there's a couple of ways to answer that question. I mean, I think that across the spectrum from investor and business and community and environment groups, you're seeing increasing pressure on government and all of the major parties to get on with it and to actually stop the wild swings back and forth in terms of the policy implementation. Because I think particularly the business and the investor side of it is that you know, inaction is not an option anymore. So if you actually have to act, then you want regulatory and policy settings which facilitate efficient action rather than necessarily no policy at all, which means you still have to do something but you don't have clarity around whether you're making the right kinds of investments. So I think in that sense that there is that pressure on government to sort it out. But also, I mean, I caveat that a little bit by saying that you know, policy frameworks and enablers are critical, but they're not the begin all end all. And I think in particular in Australia, we've had this conversation for the last few years where people keep saying we need government leadership. And I said this once to an American politician and his response was, if you want political leadership, create a parade and you'll find all the politicians at the front of it within a very short amount of time. So I kind of take that as a bit of my mantra now. I think we have a parade. We're just sort of waiting to see who pops up at the front of the crowd in terms of really driving an effective response. But, and, you know, the energy discussions will be a big test of the next few years. You know, we got off to a good start and we've sort of hit the rocky shoals pretty quickly in terms of a rational, reasonable debate around an energy pathway forward. But certainly from a business and investor perspective, everyone's saying the same thing at the moment, which is, you know, we need a plan, we need an orderly transition, we need to accommodate all of the concerns and issues for all of the impacted parties, and we need to do it sooner rather than later to reduce the cost.
Great. Well, in the interest of time, I'll close it there and just ask you to thank our panel for coming along and speaking to us today.